I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Tesco, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and a deeper connection to our own humanity. This is episode 83. It's another joint episode with Melita of Tudor Times on Mary Sidney. Just a quick note that the Renaissance English History Podcast is a proud member of the Agora Podcast Network. You can discover lots of great new podcasts at agorapodcastnetwork.com. And the podcast of the month is the Cannonball. Cannonball is a monthly podcast co-hosted by two well-educated autodidacts who are attempting to read all the books in the appendix to Harold Bloom's The Western Canon. Learn more at thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.com. Also, I need to thank a very special group of people right now, my lovely Patreon patrons. So I have a really special Patreon drive going on right now in August. It's kind of like an NPR fundraiser, but more Renaissance-y. So if you sign up at the $3 an episode level or higher, anytime during the month of August, you will get one of the 2018 Tudor planners for free in mid-November when I ship them out, and that'll be your thank you gift. So you could either keep it for yourself or you could give it as a present. This is a special way for me to thank my patrons and give away something super cool at the same time. Right now, I want to thank my current patrons, Kathy, Jurgen, Elizabeth, Cynthia, Judith, Amy, Allison, Ariel, Barbara, Joanna, Kaylee, Kathy, Christine, Annetta, Candace, Rebecca, Al, and Shandor. You guys are so amazing, and I am so deeply grateful to you. You can support the show as well and score a free Tudor planner as a thank you gift by going to englandcast.com and clicking on the Patreon link. So now let me introduce you to Melita Thomas. Melita is a co-founder and editor of Tudor Times, a website devoted to Tudor and Stuart history in the period from 1485 to 1625. You can find it at tudortimes.co.uk. Melita, who has always been fascinated by history ever since she saw the 1970s series Elizabeth R with Glenda Jackson, also contributes articles to the BBC History Extra and Britain Magazine. And she's going to be speaking at the upcoming free Tudor Summit, September 3rd and 4th. Learn more at tudorsummit.com. It's totally free. It's going to be 2 days of talks by some of the leading podcasters, historians, bloggers on lots of different aspects of Tudor history. And Melita is going to be talking about her new book on Mary Tudor. So check that out. So we're going to talk about Mary Sidney. But before we do, I just want to address an elephant in the room, as it were. In the last episode on Margaret Pole, Melita used the word niggardly to describe Henry VII. In terms of how he dealt with Margaret Pole. And the word means miserly. And there were a couple of people who were curious about it, and there were a couple of people who found it offensive. So it's really important to note that the etymology is completely different than the racial slur. It is in no way related to the racial slur. I would never I would never say that. And also in the UK, there is no controversy about this word at all. And I had no idea that there even was a controversy about it. But then a couple of people sent me emails and posted it on the Facebook page. And I realized, like, I looked it up and I saw that there's apparently a controversy around using that word. So, you know, we just kind of wanted to make it clear for anybody who still had lingering feelings of feeling offended or uncomfortable that it's not that word. Okay, so here's Melita.
I was very sorry to hear that I'd used a word that some people may have found questionable or even possibly offensive. It was absolutely not my intention to use any word that people could be offended by. And I'm terribly sorry if using a word that's acceptable in the UK has other connotations in the US that I was unaware of.
Sounds good. Obviously, we would never want to offend anybody. Everybody's welcome in Tudor England. Moving on then to Mary Sidney, Countess of Pembroke. What can you tell me about her?
Well, it's actually quite hard to tell you anything about her. What I've really discovered is how little is known about Mary Sidney herself. I was aware of Mary Sidney as she's been described as the most important non-royal woman in literary terms of the Tudor and Renaissance period, because so much work was dedicated to her, and she's mentioned in connection obviously largely with her brother Sir Philip Sidney, but also for some of her own work. But actually finding anything out about her is quite difficult. There aren't an awful lot of records giving information about her as an individual. She's always an adjunct to somebody else. But what I have found out about, so she came from a family that on both sides was very close to Elizabeth I. Her father, Sir Henry Sidney, had been a companion of Edward VI, and Edward had actually died in Henry's arms. And her mother, Mary Dudley, was the sister of Robert Dudley, Elizabeth's, her friend, her companion, probably not her lover, but the man she was undoubtedly deeply attached to. So the marriage of Henry Sidney and Mary Dudley was a marriage between two families that Elizabeth was close to. So Mary herself, she was born in 1561 in the old palace of Tickenhill near Bewdley in Worcestershire. Her father, Henry, at that time was Lord President of the Council for Wales and the Marches, and the family spent most of their time in that area. So they lived at Tickenhill, and they also spent time in Dublin during Mary's youth, as Sir Henry was posted there as Lord Deputy of Ireland as well. So Mary's youth was, she travelled a fair bit in the Marches of Wales and in Ireland, as well as living at the family home of Penshurst in Kent. There are four or five siblings in the family. There were seven siblings initially, but only three lived to full adulthood: Mary herself and her two brothers, Philip and Robert. Philip was about 6 years older than Mary, 7 years older than Mary, and she wouldn't have seen much of him during their youth, because he went to school at Shrewsbury and then he went off to university at Oxford. Her closest companion was probably her sister Ambrosia, died in 1575 when she was about 15. And this was the spur to Queen Elizabeth offering Mary a place at court as a gesture to Ambrosia's parents in their grief to comfort them. Elizabeth offered to have Mary at court, possibly to avoid infection. So in 1575, at the age of 14, Mary Sidney went to the court of the Queen. She was probably at Kenilworth, in the great pageant of 1575, where her uncle Robert made one last ditch attempt to persuade Elizabeth to marry him. Within a couple of years of joining the court, Mary was betrothed to Henry Herbert, Earl of Pembroke. He was considerably older than her. He was about 38 when she was 15, so rather a large age gap. In his youth, he had been briefly married to Lady Catherine Grey, but the marriage was annulled after the failure of the the coup, attempting to put Jane Grey on the throne. So Henry Harbutt had married the Earl of Shrewsbury's daughter but had no children. So he was keen to find a second wife who could give him a son. But also he wanted to be further associated with the Earl of Leicester and the Dudley family. Got absolutely no information at all about what their personal relationship was like. On the positive side, Pembroke himself was a learned man. He was interested in books and drama. So we can see that they had some tastes in common. Whether she already had those tastes or whether she developed them in conjunction with her husband, because obviously at 15 she was at quite an impressionable age, isn't clear. And later there are indications that Pembroke was a man of particularly violent and difficult temper. But, whether he ever treated Mary harshly, there's absolutely no information at all. They had four children, two boys, two girls. The first little girl died the day after her third birthday, which obviously very distressing for the parents. And the second daughter, Anne, lived into her early 20s, but disappeared from the record when she's about 23. Nobody seems to know quite what happened to her. But the other two sons, William and Philip, reached full adulthood and played an important part at the Stuart court. So there's Mary in her living as Countess of Pembroke in one of the most beautiful houses in England, Wilton House. It's been significantly changed since Mary's day, but it's a place well worth visiting. Very, very, very beautiful. They had a house in London. They were extremely well off. Their descendants are still in possession of Wilton House, which has never had to go to the National Trust or anything like that. So they had a good deal of money. In 1580, Mary's brother Philip, having begun a very successful career at court, fell into disgrace with the Queen. He had been part of the negotiating team for Elizabeth's possible marriage to the Duke of Anjou, but Philip was very, very much against the marriage, and he wrote a letter to the Queen, which was sort of publicised, with his objections to the marriage. Now, whether Elizabeth ever intended to marry Anjou isn't certain. She probably didn't, but she certainly didn't want Sir Philip Sidney, who was a fairly junior member of the court, publicly criticising her policy. So he was banished from court, and he went to Wilton to stay with his sister. And it's probably at this time that he introduced her. She was about 19. He was 26 to his literary friends. So Edmund Spenser, Gabriel Harvey, Fulke Greville, a whole range of Renaissance poets and writers. Also in the household was a chap called Thomas Moffat, or Muffet, possibly the origin of the nursery rhyme Little Miss Muffet about his daughter, but possibly not. So there was quite a circle of young poets and playwrights in Wilton House, and it was there that Philip started his poem The Countess of Pembroke's Arcadia, which he dedicated to Mary. Time passed, and we don't hear anything much more of what Mary was up to until 1587, which was a terrible year for her. Her father died, her mother died. She herself was very ill with something that sounds like a quinsy, an abscess in the throat, which even today they can only cure by lancing it. And that's what happened to Mary. So if you can imagine a Tudor doctor with a sharp knife in your throat, that's what poor Mary had to deal with. But she was very ill. And the doctor Moffat wrote to Philip, who was by then in Flanders. He was Governor General of the port of Flushing, as they called it in English, Vlissingen, I think it is in Flemish, as part of the English support for the Dutch attempt to cast off the shackles of Spain. So Philip got this letter saying that his sister was terribly ill, which he was very concerned about. But shortly after, at the Battle of Zutphen, Philip was severely wounded in the thigh, and he was not as lucky as his sister. He got gangrene and died again pretty horribly, I think. So that was a tough year for Mary. after Sir Philip's death, he was already, despite his being only in his mid-20s, you know, tipped for the top, as we might say now. He was highly thought of for both his literary work and also for his political skills. He was very close to the more Puritan end of Elizabeth's advisers, the Earl of Leicester. Sir Francis Walsingham was his father-in-law, and he was a strong supporter of the Protestant rebellion in the Netherlands. Mary, as she couldn't go to his funeral, women didn't go to funerals of men in those days. She was very concerned to make sure that his literary legacy was properly cared for, and she began by annotating, improving, putting together what you might call an authorized edition of his Arcadia. An early edition had been published in 1590, not long after his death. And then in 1593, Mary organized a second publication of what became known as the New Arcadia, because it contained a good deal more material than the first one. And it was at this time that she began publishing her own works, starting off with translations. She did a couple of translations from the French, from Philippe du Plessis-Mornay's Discourse on Life and Death, and also, perhaps more interestingly, a translation of a French play called Mark Antony by a chap called Robert Garnier. And she translated it into English as Antonius. And this is the first play translated or written by a woman to be published in English. And what was interesting about it, it was the start of a fashion for making current political points through the medium of Roman or Greek history. So the original play by Garnier was really all about the French religious wars, which he was a Huguenot. So again, Mary would have been aligned with the Huguenot cause. So it was quite an interesting selection of a play to translate. Her third translation work, also considered very erudite, was of Plutarch, one of Plutarch's triumphs. Plutarch had written a cycle called the Triumphs, the Triumph of Love, the Triumph of Chastity, the Triumph of Death, and so forth. And Mary translated the Triumph of Death. Mary was then working on her most famous work, the versification or the verse translation of the Psalms. This was a work that had been started by her brother Philip, and it's not clear whether it was always a joint work and that he began it and she worked with him on it, or whether he started it and she was just his sounding board. But then when he died, and he'd only done up to Psalm number 43, she completed it. Now, what's interesting about her translations and versifications is the style of them. Rather than just being straightforward translations from the Latin or the Greek or the Hebrew or whichever language she chose as her model into English, they were what's been described as aesthetic translations, because they are concentrating on the poetry and the lyrical symbolism of the Psalms themselves. And they've been described as sacred parody, the idea being that they are love poems rather than just religious works, with the idea being that the reader or the psalmist could love God as much as a romantic, with all the fervor of romantic love. Mary's the basis of her translation was the Geneva Bible translation, which was the preferred text for the Puritan end of the Protestant Church in England, rather than the Bishop's Bible, which was the official Anglican translation. And she also drew heavily on Calvin's commentaries on the Psalms. As part of her work, she looked at using different rhyme schemes. And somebody who's done a great deal of analysis, a woman called Margaret Hannay, into Mary Sidney's work, has identified, I can't remember, it was 126 or 128 different verse forms in the Psalms that she translated. So they were a religious work, but they were also a great literary showcase of Mary's talents as a poet. They were not published in her lifetime. They were dedicated to the Queen, but that's the work for which she is best known. And during all this period, other works continued to be dedicated to her, but we don't hear a great deal more about her inner life. Her husband died in the end of January 1601. That was another difficult time for Mary because her son was still underage, which meant that the Pembroke estates went into wardship, which was always an expensive business. William, her older son, was also disgraced because he had an affair with one of Elizabeth's maids of honour. The girl, Mary Fitton, was pregnant, and William absolutely point blank refused to marry her. Elizabeth was incensed. She tried to keep a very high moral tone at court. As a virgin queen, it wasn't appropriate for her attendants to have affairs and become pregnant outside marriage. Pembroke, as he now was, William, because he refused to marry, he was sent off to the Tower to think about it. But he still point blank refused to marry her. And, you know, it wasn't actually a crime, so he couldn't be kept in the Tower indefinitely. But he was then sent away from court to Wilton. So Mary obviously was upset and angry that her son had disgraced himself with the Queen. Then at the death of Elizabeth in 1603, both William and Mary's other son, Philip, were high in the favour of the new King James, who also appears to have liked Mary. He and his wife, Queen Anne, visited Wilton on at least two occasions and spent some time there. Mary's cousin, or the daughter of Mary's cousin, Lucy, Countess of Bedford, was Queen Anne's most senior lady-in-waiting. And so Mary was again close to court circles, even in the early years of King James. As time passed, of course, she retired a little from court life. She no longer lived at Wilton. She had her dower properties. She lived at Cardiff Castle was one of them, which is a very interesting place to visit. In 1612, she went abroad for her health, and she spent some 3 years in Belgium at a place called Spa. And there she became friendly with a doctor, Matthew Lister, who later rose to he became a physician to the king and lived well into his 90s, actually, a very, very long life. There was a rumour that they were secretly married, but there's no evidence of that. But I think one could infer they were slightly more than friends. She came back to England in 1615, and the king granted her a rather nice estate in Bedford near Ampt Hill, where she built the delightful Houghton House, which was probably the model for John Bunyan's The Palace Beautiful in The Pilgrim's Progress, because he came from that area of Bedfordshire. And she, as far as we can tell, because there's no more information, she divided her time between Houghton and a London property in where she died in 1621 in Aldersgate Street. She died of smallpox. She had a very grand funeral in St. Paul's Cathedral, and then she was carried by torchlit procession to Salisbury Cathedral, where she was buried. And that was the end of Mary Sidney.
So when did her writing start to become popular? Was she always respected in her own right, or did it kind of go through phases?
She was always respected, yes, from the decade or the sort of the 15 years in which she was doing the translations and the Psalms. She was highly respected. And then there were the usual arguments about, you know, how much she'd done, how much her brother had done, and so forth. But yeah, she has always been held up as a great example of female literary talent. She had a lot of influence on her niece, Mary Sidney Lady Roth, who was a writer of the next generation, and another one, Elizabeth Lady Carey. So she was another writer of the time, of the next generation. Amelia Lanyer included Mary in her a long poem that she did about prominent women, starting from the Queen and working downwards. Yeah, so she's always been very highly regarded. I mean, myself, I find certainly her letter style, which her letters, there are very few letters extant, but you know, sort of half a dozen, mostly on business. But there are two or three that are what you might call letters of compliment to the Queen, which are so convoluted and in the style of the time, very similar to the style in which Elizabeth herself wrote, full of double meanings and repetition of the same word to have a different meaning. It's really quite hard to make head or tail of. But they were very much admired at the time and given as they were used as examples in books of how to write beautiful letters.
Can you tell me a little bit about? I know it's kind of something that happens a lot with. There was an artist. Was it Nicholas Hilliard who had a sister, and they say that possibly some of his miniatures were actually painted by her. And I know there's stories like this when you've got a woman and a man who are either husband and wife or brother and sister who are close that you get these controversies around authorship. What was there with her with that?
Really, it was about how much she changed or altered the Arcadia. So it would appear from both Philip's work and Mary's work that they were the kind of people who constantly tinker with it. So there, insofar as people can tell from putting together, you know, bits of manuscript here and there, there are lots and lots of revisions of everything that they did. So Philip, it appears, wrote a poem called Arcadia, and he then made quite a few revisions to that and added some different endings or a more complex ending. And the first publication of it, which was called The Old Arcadia, seems to have been based on his original manuscript. Then the publication of 1593 that Mary took charge of became known as The New Arcadia, which had this new ending and some other changes. And the question is, you know, did she make up that ending, or does it actually come from the notes and the manuscripts that she had of his? Current thinking seems to be that it was his work, and that she used, you know, his annotations to make the changes. With the Psalms, he is always attributed to doing the first 43, and she did the subsequent ones. But how much they discussed his 43 before he died, and whether she input into those or whether they just talked about them isn't clear. John Donne, the other great poet of the era, he wrote an ode praising them both as the translators of these sonnets, as Moses and Miriam, biblical allusions there. So yeah, so she was always well thought of in her time.
So something I read about her family as well was that they supported one of the early theater troupes.
Yes, well, I mean, at that time, actors could only act if they were sort of officially belonged to somebody suitable. So there was the Lord Chamberlain's men, and there were Lord Pembroke's players, and there were a few others. Anyway, so Lord Pembroke's players, who may in the early days have included Shakespeare. The jury's still out on that one. But it is, then there were the Lord Chamberlain's players who did include Shakespeare, and they were certainly patronised by Mary and played at Wilton. And it's likely, or certainly possible, that the first rendition of As You Like It was performed at Wilton by Shakespeare and his company. And it was to Mary's sons, William and Philip, that the first folio was of Shakespeare's work was dedicated. So there was a good deal of support of drama we could infer from that.
Why did you choose her as the person of the month, and what is it about her that is worth knowing about and studying?
We chose her because, well, partly to have a different perspective from just politics, although, of course, looking at what we do know of her work and her, you know, you can't get away from the politics in that, I mean, particularly the Psalms, religion was a political act in those days. The relationship between, you know, Mary's, the sort of political affiliations of the Dudleys and the Sidneys as being more radically Protestant and very much more inclined to intervention in the Netherlands than some of the other members of Elizabeth's court, certainly much more than Elizabeth herself ever wanted to get involved. She really didn't want to get involved at all, but she was forced into it eventually by circumstance and also by constant pressure from the you know, those who are in favor of it. So it was interesting to try to find out more about it, about somebody else who, you know, with a different perspective. But the tricky bit, of course, is because she was a woman and she didn't hold any high office and she wasn't a queen, it, you know, information about her is not that comprehensive. I think it's an interesting a period generally when, well, I suppose the generation after Mary's is probably the last of the generations that were highly educated for a long time. So female education came to the fore in the 15, well, in the late 15th century. And then, you know, it really gathered pace in the 1520s and 30s. The two queens regnant, Mary and Elizabeth, were both very highly educated. And there was a great fashion for it in the middle of the 16th century, which lasted probably until early in the 17th century, after which female education, even amongst the elite, seemed to slip back somewhat. I mean, there were, you know, outstanding examples, but it wasn't as widespread as it was in Mary's generation.
Sure. Yeah. I think about that whole, all of that time period, even starting with Catherine of Aragon's mother, and Catherine of Aragon planned out Mary's education and everything.
Yeah.
It was such an important part.
Yes. But, you know, by the time you get to the mid 17th century, I mean, James II's daughters, who became queens themselves, Queen Mary II and Queen Anne, you know, they could barely write. I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but, you know, it wasn't considered at all necessary for them to be educated.
Okay, so where can we find out more about her?
With great difficulty, I have to say. I have been trawling all over the place to find out information. I mean, there is, as always, there's stuff in the calendars of state papers from the reigns of Elizabeth and James. Biographies by Philip sort of mention her, but it's mostly by reading learned articles in literary and academic journals about literature that the odd facts come to light. The only sort of the best biography, or the most comprehensive one, is it dates back to the early 20th century. I mean, it's by Frances Young, I think it is. So if you can get your hands on a copy of that, obviously we've done the piece on the Tudor Times website, and there is a bibliography which will give some ideas as to where you can look.
Perfect. Anything else that I should be asking?
Don't think so. It's funny, I have very little sense of her personality, because there's just not enough to know, really. I'm glad she had the lover in old age. Who apparently she didn't leave a will. Her effects just went to her sons, but they rather kindly gave Matthew Lister a pension. And in one of the descriptions of her funeral, somebody comments that he was well worn in the Countess's service. Yeah, so that's just one little snippet on her character.
Thank you again to Melita Thomas for taking the time to tell us about Mary Sidney. For more information on her, go to tudortimes.co.uk, or you can also see the resources available on the Englandcast site at englandcast.com. And remember, if you like this show, the biggest way you can help it, which is totally free, is to leave a review on iTunes and to tell a friend about it. Seriously, you tell your friends to listen, right? In the next episode in 2 weeks, actually, I was going to do food. I'm skipping. I know you guys hate it when I do this. I'm really sorry. I try not to do it more than once or twice a year. I want to talk more about food, but because the solar eclipse is happening in the US, I've been wanting to do an episode on astronomy and on science in Tudor England anyway, and I think that now's kind of the timely time to do it. So I'm working on an episode on astronomy and on science in general in Tudor England. It was such a time of, you know, Copernicus and moving from this Earth-centered universe to the Sun-centered universe or galaxy, solar system. So I'm working on an episode on that. So stay tuned for that, and then we'll go back to food and dining and manners and things like that. Stay tuned for that, and also remember the very special Patreon deal for those of you who support me during my Patreon membership drive, as it were. Thanks so much for listening, you guys, and I will talk with you again in about 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Blow, northern wind, ascend, who may be sweet.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
ACAST helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. ACAST.com.